Hello, and welcome to Introducing Me. I'm your host, Sarah. I started this podcast to get to know other people and lifestyles while discovering more about myself. Each episode, I will give a new guest a chance to discuss their background, culture, interests, or whatever they want to talk about to help increase all of our own worldviews. Today, I would like to introduce you to Dr. Eric Hinton. Eric was my professor at Susquehanna University. He is the director of bands there. So in addition to being my professor, he was also my private lesson teacher, my boss. So I got to know him pretty well over the 4 years, but we were joking before this that I was like, I know you in a professional work student relation status and not really your background. So I'm excited for him to share a little bit more about his life here. And I'm so thankful for him to take the time out of his day today. So Eric, why don't you go on and say hello? Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, hello. As you mentioned, I'm the director of bands at Susquehanna. I'm originally from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, one of three children, did my undergrad at Northwestern University and my master's at Northwestern in conducting, then went off to Germany for a while and then did a PhD at the Royal Birmingham Conservatoire and came on back to the wonderful United States and have been here at Susquehanna for 15 years.
Wow. Congratulations on 15 years.
Thank you.
So we're going to start randomly in the middle of all of that. What made you go abroad for your later degrees?
Well, it was something that I always wanted to do. When I was in eighth grade, we did a trip to Paris and London with my middle school. I went to Masterman in Philadelphia, which is a fairly well-known middle school. Now it's actually all the way through from, I think, kindergarten all the way through to high school. But at that time, it only went up to eighth grade, and then they started adding grades. Anyway, we had this trip that we would go abroad. The French class went to Paris, and then we did a little bit in London. And I just thought it was an amazing experience, and I've always wanted to go back and try to think of ways that I could do that and make money. When I was teaching middle school in Winnetka, Illinois, my orchestra colleague, I mentioned that to her, and she brought in this paper called The International Educator, and had an ad for this German-American school in Berlin. And I applied and got the gig. And so my wife and I, we threw all of our stuff in a container that went across the ocean, and we flew and moved to Berlin. We stayed there for 7 years. And for me, it was just about the culture. It was about music and trying to get some experience conducting abroad. And it was only supposed to be for 2 years. And then you could ask for an extension for another three. And so we did that. And then the next step was tenure, which meant that you would be considered like a German Beamte, and it would be a job that you could have for life if you decided to stay. And so I applied for the tenure process and got that. And so I had, you know, a German residency stamp, and we were going to stay there forever. And then I decided that I wanted to get a PhD and did not want to come back to the United States to do it. So I ended up doing that in Birmingham, England, and stayed there for 8 years. And then it was, you know, well, the kids are a certain age, and we need to think about schooling and what are our prospects here in the UK and what would be the prospects at home. And so we decided to come back. And that's how I ended up at Susquehanna.
I was going to say, like, you were there for quite some time. So what was the, like, culture experiences? Did you ever have culture shock going from Philly to Illinois to Germany to England? And, like, back here, you've been so many different places.
Yeah, well, I think the biggest culture shock initially was moving from the States to Germany, because everything was different. And, you know, we ended up in Berlin, and, you know, the school finds you an apartment. And because it's a school, they have teachers who are going back to the States and then the teachers who are coming. And so they pair you with people and you can buy some of their stuff so that you don't have to bring certain things. And so, you know, we got their apartment and they sold us their car, but they just kind of plop you in the middle of this town a couple of weeks before school starts. And until the orientation begins, you're kind of on your own. So you go into the grocery store and you can't read any of the labels. You don't know what you're buying most of the time. And so that was very different. And, you know, all the other differences, I think, you know, took some getting used to, but they were pleasant experiences. They were pleasant differences. And there wasn't really much of a shock going from Germany to Great Britain, I guess because I had been abroad so long by that time and had visited England anyway while we were living in Berlin. And so that wasn't so bad. But then coming from Birmingham to Selinsgrove was probably the biggest of all the shocks, actually, just because, you know, what we had become so accustomed to after 15 years by that time in Europe and then coming back to a small town in central Pennsylvania, that took a lot of adjusting, I think, for everyone.
I think that makes sense. And I've heard it a bit when I've talked to different people about culture shock, that Selinsgrove can be very culture shock, just because it is so small town and I'm sure very different from growing up in Philadelphia.
For sure.
So what was it like in Philly? You said you were one of three children. So what was your experience growing up?
Okay, well, I was the youngest. And, you know, our parents were very sort of education oriented. In fact, you know, all of my two siblings, they both have master's degrees and, you know, are very accomplished in their own right. And my school was across the street from my house. So I was never late to school. That was nice. And then, you know, at a certain point in elementary school, we got tested academically. And so I was given the opportunity to go to Masterman, this wonderful school in the center of the city. And so that just opened up a lot of things for me, the trip to Paris and London. And then my involvement in music. I was in the orchestra. And had great teachers, and that was, you know, a wonderful thing for me to be around all that culture, to go to then from Masterman to Central High School, which is, I think, the second oldest high school in the country, second oldest public high school in the country. And, you know, that was an all-boys school at the time. It's not any longer, but it was an all-boys school at the time. And the girls' high school of Philadelphia was right down the street. And so, again, a lot of music, a lot of camaraderie, and just great experiences with the program there and doing Masterworks concerts with the girls at Girls High and then being a part of the All-City Orchestra, the All-City Band. It was just a great time.
It sounds like your path then to decide to become a full-time music professor definitely makes sense hearing what you were doing even just in high school. So when and how did you figure out that you wanted to get all of those degrees?
Well, I don't know that you ever go into it thinking I want to get all of these degrees. But I knew, I suppose, maybe halfway through high school. I mean, I went through a lot of different phases. I used to think about being an architect. I wanted to be a mathematician at one point. I was way into biology for a little while. But, you know, ultimately my involvement in music and, you know, being given leadership roles in our program, that was what sort of made me really excited and was that thing that I couldn't imagine not doing. And so, you know, it was a very interesting situation at Central because we didn't have a band. We had a marching band, but we didn't have a concert band. We had an orchestra. And our band director or orchestra director, Steve Walensky, just retired, actually, not that long ago. But he was a flautist in the American Ballet Theater. So he was a real serious musician with a pedigree. And so, you know, he instilled a lot of things in me that I take with me, you know, to this day. And so thinking about a career in music was something that I discussed with him. We talked about music education versus performance. And, you know, I decided on the music ed aspect. I was the drum major in the high school band. And so the conducting thing kind of excited me. And that was the first inkling that I knew that that's what I wanted to do. And then from there, it kind of snowballs. You know, you do your undergrad and you do all the music stuff, theory, history, and whatever. And then having my first real conducting class was extremely exciting. I just loved it to death. And all the things that you do as a music education student, observing other teachers, doing all kinds of internships and student teaching. And, you know, as I said, I had great teachers and mentors. One of my student teaching cooperating teacher was at Nutria High School in Winnetka, which is one of those really great, well-known programs. And he was a phenomenal teacher to me and gave me lots of great experiences. And that made me even more passionate about what I wanted to do.
And now I gave a little bit, and because I was a student at Susquehanna, I know what you were doing at Susquehanna, but do you want to talk about your job currently?
Sure. As a director of bands, I have a few different hats. I obviously conduct the bands at Susquehanna. When I first got there, we had a symphonic band, and then I added the wind ensemble, which historically is a more advanced group with more emphasis on sort of chamber music approach to playing, more difficult repertoire, and so we kind of added that facet to the program. I also teach trumpet and teach other courses in music education like the Brass Method series and the conducting series. I've taught beginning conducting and instrumental conducting as well. You know, every once in a while, when there's time, I teach a course in the history and literature of the wind orchestra, which is something that is near and dear to my heart, and has a lot to do with what I, you know, wrote about when I was a doctoral student.
And what is your favorite thing to teach?
Well, my favorite thing is conducting. That working with the ensembles is my favorite thing, for sure. You know, thinking about the repertoire that we choose and what it can teach the students, and being a part of the process where we learn the repertoire, and sometimes it's an easy process, sometimes it's a more arduous process, but certainly that's the most fun part, is getting from that very first day where you're seeing it for the first time, and just thinking about how you learn, you know, sort of how it goes and how you want to present it to audiences.
And I'm going to ask the dreaded question, how has it been teaching since last March?
Actually, I think it's been pretty good. I mean, for me personally, one, I've been really impressed with the university and how they handled the crisis and how flexible they were and how willing they were to provide us with what we needed to be effective as teachers. And for us in the band program, that meant, you know, because we have issues that other disciplines don't, because, you know, students can sit and learn and not speak or speak minimally in a classroom, whereas if you're in an ensemble, aerosols are flying everywhere. And so, you know, we had to think about distancing, which everybody had to think about, but we also had to think about having covers for mouthpieces and that sort of thing, and covers for the bells, the ends of the instruments. So all those things had to go into it. And, you know, we also had to be conscious of the capacity of the rooms, which changed because of the distancing. So rather than having an ensemble of 60, the pieces that we played were from between 6 performers up to 23. So that's a very different kind of repertoire, and the students were great and flexible and really adapted to the situation well. And I think also the fact that we were doing chamber music changed the process and made them think a little bit more differently about the music. And because they were smaller pieces, the parts were more sort of one and apart, since, it was like chamber music, and the students all of a sudden had more responsibility. You know, instead of being in a clarinet section of 15, where, you know, there might be 5 firsts, 5 seconds, and so on, there was only 1 first and only 1 second. And so you had to know your part in and out, and you had a lot of responsibility. And the students enjoyed that, I think.
I know that I definitely enjoyed when I was placed in a small ensemble. I was kind of asked because they needed another person. So I can understand how that would have been enjoyable, and especially when probably a lot of other things were remote. Did you have to do any remote teaching?
Oh, for sure, yeah. The most arduous time, I think, was at the middle of last of the spring semester, where we were going fine until about March, and we had to go remote. And we were all kind of scrambling to figure out what we were doing. Brass class, which is a very difficult class to teach remotely, because it's about how to teach brass instruments. We had to do that remotely. And so that was a bit scary at first. But, you know, we adapted and we figured out things. And that's kind of, you know, we were talking about apps for recording and stuff. And that's where some of that came in. They were recording their performances on their secondaries and sending them to me. Conducting was also an adjustment. You can imagine that's an ensemble experience. And the conductors had to really, again, this is where sort of the adapting made the students pick up more responsibility, because we didn't have an ensemble to conduct. You had to sing your parts and conduct them. And so that meant, you know, that they had to really hit the score study and be able to recreate the score as best you can with your voice and with your gesture. And so I think in a lot of ways that challenge helped. And so it actually, you know, sort of drove the point home how important it is to know your score. And then over the summer, we had this wonderful teaching and learning institute where we had to learn more about teaching remotely and teaching hybrid courses. And so I picked up a lot of interesting skills through those little mini courses, and that helped me quite a bit going into the fall.
Yeah, it sounds like I would not have wanted to do that as a student. So I give props to every student who has had to go through that. I'm also zero passion for doing music education. I think everyone who does it is great, and it's a lot of work. I enjoyed getting my music BA and stopping it there.
Well, I thought it was wonderful that you know, all the students in the fall came back, you know, and they were ready to go, and they were ready to meet the challenge and to be flexible and to, you know, make the best of the situation. And that was the thing to me that was most gratifying, is that, you know, there was no complaining. There was no, this isn't what I signed up for kind of an attitude. People just jumped in and they did what they were supposed to do. And I thought, again, as a university, we were really accommodating, you know, for the methods courses, again, that were starting at the beginning of the fall, when we knew what we were walking into. You know, we sent secondary instruments to students through the mail, or we you know, met in neutral places and students came and picked up instruments before the semester started. You know, I sat in a mall in Tannersville in the parking lot with a van full of violins, trumpets, and other brass and strings to give to students who lived in that area so that they could have instruments to play from home, because we were going to be remote.
Wow. And that's, I know I've seen things online, like the first couple pictures that came out with students having the shields, as you were talking about. And I just remember thinking, like, I'm so happy that there are these accommodations and that the Susquehanna was seemingly doing a great job. And you've confirmed it here as well, that for the situation they had, it was as good as it could be.
Yeah, I think so. I thought that was all handled and planned really, really well.
Now, I know at Susquehanna, you also help out with some of the fraternities. So what else do you do outside of teaching in general?
Yeah, I am the faculty advisor for Phi Beta Sigma, which is a historically African-American fraternity. And we started that, I think it's like 10 years now. Because there weren't any African-American fraternities or sororities on campus, and we wanted students to have that experience. And there have been some issues with students trying to acclimate to the white ones. And so we started Phi Beta Sigma fraternity and Sigma Gamma Rho sorority with the idea that there would be a grad chapter and an undergraduate chapter, and that the grad chapter would mentor the undergrad chapter. And so I'm working with the Sigmas throughout the year and enjoying that quite a bit.
I didn't know that you had actually started the organization, so that's really cool, and that must be really close to you. Were you a part of a chapter when you were an undergrad?
I was not. I was not. I was At something that I had considered, but, you know, being a music student in the time that that takes, it just wasn't something that worked out for me. But, you know, thinking about how important it is and what the needs of the situation on campus here were, I was very happy to join the graduate chapter here and to mentor the younger guys.
Cool. Do you have any issues? You know, you mentioned that big culture shock coming to Selins Grove. Selins Grove is a very white area. And, you know, even just knowing that 10 years ago, Susquehanna University, which has multiple fraternities and sororities, didn't have any black groups. Have you had any issues, or is Susquehanna and Selins Grove kind of become home and everything now is good?
That's a very difficult subject, I think, to talk about. And yeah, there are issues, I think, anywhere you go. But I think being in the middle of Pennsylvania, and we are smack dab in the middle of Trump country here, that there are bound to be issues. And I don't worry so much about myself as I do students. And that's another thing I think that the university has been good about confronting. And we had the census task force that met this past summer to confront some of those problems that we all know about, especially in the wake of the election and the things that might come about as a result of the rhetoric that's been going on. And so, you know, there are things in place in the university, I think, that are hopefully going to make a difference for all of our students, not just the students of color.
Yeah, and I appreciate, I know that those sort of topics are a little bit difficult, so I appreciate your willingness to answer it. Now, when you came back to Selins Grove, how old were your kids?
They must have been around 11, because they're 26 now. So, and we've been here for 15 years, so they were around 11.
Okay, so what was it like bringing them back, or I guess not even back to the States, but to the States for the first time, like permanently, and having them grow up here?
I think that it was an adjustment, and I think because the education systems are so different, there were things that teachers had to adjust to, because, you know, the way certain things are taught in Britain is very different than the way they're taught here. You know, in Britain, there's open punctuation, that was a little bit hard for the teachers to adjust to. There are just different ways the languages function. You know, it's two countries separated by a common language is the saying that we have. And so, you know, there were adjustments, and, you know, certainly there were visits to schools and discussions and teacher conferences. But, you know, I think they just had to kind of get used to sort of the way American students function in school. You know, it's just different, you know.
Yeah, I have no experience doing like regular education outside of the U.S., but I can only imagine. Now, I meant to ask this earlier. Do you speak any other languages besides English?
I speak German.
Okay. So, how long did it take you while you were in Germany to get used to German?
I mean, it's a hard question to sort of quantify. I made a conscious effort to learn the language. And, you know, at a place like the John F. Kennedy Schule, you could, as an American teacher, go your time there and not learn the language. That there are enough people who speak English to a level that you could kind of function without really learning German. But I wanted to learn, and I thought, you know, I'm surrounded by all of this. It'd be a shame not to take it in. And so I did things, you know, very intentionally. Like, you know, when we were there, there were still American Army bases in Berlin, because the wall had just come down. And so there were still Army bases there, and they offered language classes. And so I took some of those. And also I went to the Goethe Institute, which offered language classes, and took some classes with them, And then one of those teachers, I ended up going to his house in a different part of the city called Kreuzberg, and he taught me German privately. I should back up, too. It started, actually, one of the teachers that was at our school and lived in our building, we lived in an apartment building when we first got there, had taught German in America and taught some of the couples German in his apartment once a week. And so we would go to his apartment. There were about six of us, and he would teach us German. And that's how it started. And then I went to the military classes for German, and then the Goethe Institute, and then the private German. And I also joined a Lions Club. There was a Lions Club that started there in an area of Berlin. And the as they were starting that club, I was asked to join. And so all of the meetings, all the business was in German. And I thought that was a great way to be immersed in it. And some of them spoke English, some of them didn't. Some of them were older and didn't speak German, didn't speak English. So that was a very immersive experience as well. So, I'm out of practice, so I don't speak it as well as I used to. But, you know, I speak it with some of my colleagues at Susquehanna who are German, and that keeps me a little bit fresh and into it.
I was going to ask if you had the chance, but it sounds like there's at least a little bit of a chance, which is always good. Have you had the chance to go back abroad in the last 15 years?
I have. I had several gigs that were sort of holdovers from when I was over there that I went back for in the last couple of the first few years that I was here. I also had an opportunity to conduct the U.S. Army Europe Band, which is based in Heidelberg. I did that a few years ago, and they were putting on a series of concerts called Hands Across the Sea, and they had invited a prominent British military bandsman, a conductor, to do a piece, and one from Germany, and the commandant, or the commander of the U.S. Army band, did a piece, and they invited me to do something as well. So that was a nice experience. And we did three concerts in the Heidelberg area, and I got a chance to speak to the audience, and I did that in German, just to kind of, you know, take that chance and keep those skills alive. And so that was fun. That was a lot of fun. But I was conducting the U.S. Army Europe Band, and the piece that I chose, you were asked to pick something that was sort of indicative of your country. And so we did Suite of Old American Dances by Robert Russell Bennett. And so that was kind of a fun experience.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Now, you mentioned at one point what you were focusing your studies on while you were a student. And I know that you've taken sabbatical at least once in the last 15 years because you did it while I was a student. So what opportunities have you had to study continuously outside of teaching?
So this is the sort of the research that I do, and there are a couple things that I'm interested in. One thing that I've been looking at is learning about how to apply the principles of a man named Rudolf von Laban, who was a dancer choreographer, and he did a lot of study on movement. And I've been doing some things and writing some things about how to apply that to conducting classes and how those movements help, especially beginning conductors who are awkward and very, very concerned about how they look rather than thinking about the music and how they can sort of shed some of that excess weight and be more expressive. That's one of the things that I've been pursuing. Then the other thing is trying to find and look at music of African-American composers, things that they've written for the wind band. And one of the things that we did a few years ago is we did a collaborative project with the chairman of the Africana Studies Department, where, you know, the pieces that we chose, he and I delivered some lectures on that music, putting it in a social context, and also did a pre-concert talk to do the same kind of thing for the audience.
That's really awesome that you're looking at both of those things, and I think that they are great points of study.
For sure, yeah. And I think that the African American composer project that we were working on was interesting because students didn't know a lot of that material, and it's not something that is taught in school in any substantive way. But they were very eager to learn it, and I think for the performers it really helped to put the music in some sort of context that informed the performance in a very positive way.
Well, and so much of music history is so old. Music history was probably my least favorite music course that I had to take. I have admitted to the fact that I am not a history person, and the things just don't tend to stick. But it is so much older, and we get into 20th century, but, you know, I think more now probably so than ever before, we are talking about race, but even then, the textbooks are filled with white people.
Yes, and I think that, you know, learning about people of color in all different sort of areas that have contributed and that have enriched our lives is valuable, is certainly important. And, you know, with the things that have been going on across the country, that's become a lot of what people are talking about these days.
Definitely. Now, what have you not yet shared about your life that you would like to share with the listeners?
Well, this is kind of a silly thing, but I love golf. That might not be as well known as it should be, I suppose. I'm not good at it, but I do enjoy playing it. And whenever I do something right or make a long putt or hit a really good shot, it's just enough to get me to come back the next time. It you know, alleviates my frustration to the extent that I know that I'll want to go back out again.
Do you golf often?
I mean, during the pandemic, obviously, I didn't do anything, which was very, very, very sad. But, you know, in the summer when I can, I golf as much as I can.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely did not know that about you.
Yeah. And I've actually had a lesson with, do you remember, Darby Orris?
Yes.
I've had a lesson with her father. Her father was a golf coach, at Mifflinburg High School. And he's given me, I think, one or two lessons.
I've always thought that it would be so good to get into golf, but I feel like it's very overwhelming to me to even try, like, beyond the I'm really decent at mini golf. My golf knowledge is so minimal.
Well, I think it probably would have been easier for me to learn it earlier. I didn't start playing golf until, I think, around 2009. I used to teach at a music camp where we taught and conducted and did all of our sort of music stuff between 8 and noon. And then from noon on, we were free. And so I would spend that. I started, you know, the very first summer I think I went there, I bought a set of golf clubs with the intention of, you know, learning that in the afternoon. I had never golfed before, and so I kind of taught myself. And that was pretty appalling. And very frustrating, but I did get some lessons while I was there, and just, you know, it's a very, when you start late, I think it's a very, very long process, a difficult process. I wish I had done it earlier, and then I would be in a different place, but I just love getting out there. Golf courses tend to be gorgeous. I remember, going to a conference to present in Hawaii, several years ago, and making sure that I got on the golf course while I was there. And it was right over the ocean, and it was just a gorgeous day. And so things like that just kind of, you know, are real big pick-me-ups.
Well, and it's something that you can do pretty much anywhere. Did you have any athletic experience growing up?
No. In a word, no. I mean, I did things that, you know, all kids do. You know, you go around, you play basketball, and You play football in the yard or in the on the playground, but no, I was not in any organized sports when I was a kid. I was in the band.
that was all that mattered, was being in the band.
That's all that mattered. I was in the band. Yep. And then I was leading the band, so that was even better.
Now I do, and I thought of this when you mentioned before, and you just said it again. You were leading the band. You were the drum major. The Susquehanna does not have a marching band. They used to back in the day. What is your opinion on Susquehanna not having a marching band?
Well, I feel like with the size of our school and the emphasis of our music department, I'm not sure that it's something that works well for us. I think that the stadium band and what we do in terms of promoting school spirit and the kind of music that we're able to explore and have fun with, I think that's right for the size of our program. You know, for a marching band to exist, to me, it would be a huge expense. And would also require things of music majors that might take away from them becoming better musicians. And I think that our emphasis is on our instrumentalists becoming the best musicians that they can be, and the social aspects and the that sort of stuff can happen in other ways. And the esprit de corps that you learn as a part of a marching band can happen in other ways. And for our music ed majors, you know, we provide them with opportunities where they can get some of those skills. And you know, all the students who come to us have been in marching bands for their entire time leading up to school. So they have had a lot of that. And then, you know, doing things in a way where they maybe are interning with a program that has a marching band, a high school program, that's going to be closer to what they'll be doing as music teachers anyway. So they can get those experiences that way.
Yeah, that makes sense. I know, as I would hear students say, like, oh, I wish we had a marching band. Like, I was drum major. I really loved it. I would be sitting there, like, thinking exactly what you're saying. Like, it's a time commitment. And to truly do it well, and especially Pennsylvania is really big on marching band and, like, being really committed and doing all of the competitions, that it would have to be a really good program, and there just isn't time in the student's day.
Well, and I kind of took a straw poll, you know, on a couple of different occasions where I would ask the question, what do you think, you know, should we have a marching band? And, you know, you can find as many students who are glad that we don't have one that wish we had one. So I don't know, you know, if you could please everybody. I think, you know, you're going to disappoint some who would like to have it. But I think that, you know, what we do with stadium band is good for us.
Yeah.
At least at the moment.
Well, and hey, I came to Susquehanna, and one of my main things about the music department was I want to be in a stadium band. So it was enough for me.
I'm glad we were there for you.
Well, I mean, I came in without the music major. My goal was to play in stadium band, and that was it. But then I got a scholarship which required me to take lessons and ensemble, and left with so much more.
Well, I'm glad, like I said, I'm glad we were there for you.
So I know one of the big things that Susquehanna does, and something I was very involved in working with you, is the Honors Band, which is for high school students. We would have tons of students coming to the university for a weekend. So what has changed with the pandemic, and what are you able to do for your high school programs to get students interested in music beyond high school?
Yeah, we were very lucky last year that we were able to have it in its usual form. And we had a wonderful guest conductor, and it went extremely well last year, one of our best ones, I think. We made the decision fairly early on, you know, knowing what was going on with COVID-19, that we would not be able to have Honors Band in the usual way. But at the same time, we didn't want to give up the contact that we had with high school students. We think that's just so important for them, what we can offer them, and so important for us, you know, for them to know what we do and that we're here. And so we moved the Honors Band to a virtual format that rather than it being 3 days, you know, we used to have students come in on a Friday and audition for seating and rehearse all day Saturday and do a gig on Sunday. This year we're having a 1 day event that starts at 9 a.m. And goes through till about 2:30. And it'll be divided into different sort of sessions. The focus of the day is going to be a piece by an African-American composer named Omar Thomas, who's written a piece called Sharp Nine. And I like this piece, one, because it's a New Orleans-style march over blues changes. And there's room for students who want to improvise. And the nice thing about it that works for us in terms of the virtual nature of the festival is that it's written in a flexible format. So there are five parts that can be assigned to various instruments, and it's not sort of a set instrumentation that's written in stone. So that's a wonderful thing. And so there'll be chances for students to work with faculty and sectionals to go over the music and the stylistic context of it. There's also a chance to rehearse with me virtually and to talk about the piece. And to there'll be a session by a wonderful trumpet player who's an SU alum, Dale Orris, who's going to talk about improvisation and help students who are new to that, you know, with some tips. Because, you know, this is still a band piece, and so we don't often get to hear clarinets and flutes and oboes improvise. But those spaces in this piece do exist, and I'm looking forward to encouraging students to take advantage of that. And so he'll be delivering an hour session on improvisation. And then we're going to also offer a space for different sessions for students to kind of go where their interests take them. One will be a Q&A with students. One is going to be a session on careers in music. There's going to be one on breathing for wind players. One on taking auditions well. And so there'll be some things for students to choose from. And then we're going to finish with a faculty recital that will be a combination of live stream performance and pre-recorded performance of our wonderful faculty playing various solo works. So it'll be a nice way for us to still interact with students and give them some of our passion for music, and hopefully they'll come away learning things that they didn't know before.
Yeah, it sounds like a great opportunity. And I'm sitting here listening to you talk about some of the sessions, and I studied with Dale the semester that you were on sabbatical. And I'm like, this is only for high schoolers. Like, how can I get in on listening to these talks? So when is it? I know it's normally early February, I think.
So this will be on February 20th. Information about how to register will be, if you just go to the Susquehanna University Music Department website, there should be a space there for all of our high school programs. And so you should be able to find your way to registration form pretty easily. If you have trouble finding your way there, just email me at hinton@susqu.edu, and I'll be happy to send you a link to the form.
Awesome. And I can definitely leave more information in the description about these programs and all of the contact information.
That'd be awesome.
All right. So with all of my guests, I like to end it out with a random question. And I'm curious to know, if you could live anywhere in the world, where would you choose to be? And maybe this is like after retirement, so you don't have, you know, responsibilities. Where would you like to go?
That's a great question. When my wife and I lived in Berlin and we were without children, we loved to travel. We loved to travel with them, but we loved to travel without them when we were younger. You know, I am the kind of person who likes to plan a trip. You know, we have an itinerary, a list of places we're supposed to go, things we need to see in this particular town. And we took a trip to the south of France, and we drove. We drove from Berlin to the south of France, and we were going to see all these places. And my wife said, enough of this. We got to this one town called Arles. Arles in the south of France. It's near Avignon. And she said, stop. You know, we're going to throw the plan out the window and we are going to stay in this town for a couple of days. And I said, yeah, okay, fine. And so I think one of the places that you know, I would love to retire is in Arles. It's a place that Vincent van Gogh had visited. And in fact, I believe that's the town where he cut off his ear. And it's just a wonderful town. It has an old Roman Colosseum in it, wonderful restaurants. We had our hotel was in a square that was bordered by other hotels and cafes. And it's just a great place. You know, you eat outdoors. And I think, you know, everything just sort of slowed down when we got there. And I'm so glad that I listened to my wife and we just stopped and enjoyed that place. So I think that'd be close to the top of the list.
Cool. It sounds like such a beautiful place. And I love that you had such a plan. And like, I am someone who will also plan that much. And then you were like, okay, we can throw it out the window.
We threw it out the window. And we drank Cote de Rhone and just enjoyed ourselves.
All right, that brings this episode to a close. Like I mentioned, I will be leaving the information about Susquehanna and how to get in contact with Eric if you have further questions in the description. And if you would like more information about the podcast, of course, that information is always there as well. We are on social media, so you can connect with us via Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn. And if you'd like to be a guest on the podcast, you can always shoot me an email at introducingmepodcast@gmail.com. And thank you so much, Eric, or Dr. Hinton, as I used to call you and as all the students call you, so much for spending time with me today. I really appreciate it, and I appreciated learning a little bit more about you. And thank you so much to my listeners for taking the time out of your day to hear a new story. Until next week, bye.
Bye, folks.